Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
Did you raise concerns about Russia's support for President Bashar Assad and his campaign of indiscriminate violence against his own citizens, including his use of chemical weapons?
I don't recall whether that was discussed or not.
And all of a sudden, from around the third base dugout, just a loud crack. And somebody said, that sounds like a gun. And then boom, boom, started going again. And then we knew it was.
I absolutely was remembering the moments of where I was and that day in January of 2011 and felt as horrified this morning as I did then.
There is a solid correlation of how many times an opioid abuser has been taken to the hospital for an overdose before they die. It's something like 3 times. So patient tracking would allow that touch point to get to them sooner in an attempt to save lives, because that is what public health is about.
And here with us to discuss Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony, the attack on members of Congress on a Virginia baseball field, as well as changing policies on opioid data reporting in Arizona, are Arizona's former Attorney General Terry Goddard and former State School Superintendent Jaime Molera of the firm Molera Alvarez. Guys, thanks for being here. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Terry, let me start with you. What did you make of Attorney General Sessions' testimony?
Well, as a strategist, and I guess we shouldn't really go any further without expressing, you know, horror and remorse over the shootings. That was, obviously a surge of violence that Speaker Ryan and others spoke out against very effectively, and I hope the nation pays attention, because taking our political differences into weapon discharge, I think, has got to stop.
And which we definitely want to dig into.
Certainly reminded of Gabby Giffords and the tragic shooting in 2011. As a lawyer, I was a little astonished at the Sessions session, in that he claimed he refused to claim a privilege, but he didn't say anything anyway. Which I think members of the Senate can and may dig into much more deeply, because he, very specific, he was not claiming executive privilege, but he wasn't answering the question anyway. And in criminal law, at least, there's a set of sanctions for doing that, for basically violating your pledge to speak fully and honestly, which you have to take when you swear yourself in as a witness. So not a lot of fundamental information, except a lot of pushback from Attorney General Sessions, somebody that was in the state attorney general's circle many years ago before he became a senator, and was not the brightest bulb on the porch in that context. And I'm afraid his testimony sort of showed the same belligerence, some charm, but not a lot of substance.
Jaime, how much substance do you expect to get out of the congressional hearings into potential Russian meddling and everything else that is going on in Washington, versus what might come out of either the classified settings, the closed-door settings, or what the special counsel is investigating?
I'm not so sure you can get a lot of information from these types of hearings. One of the things that surprises me a little bit, it seems like a Chinese water torture for the Trump administration when it comes to the Russian issue, because it's a story that's not going away. As much as they want to try and tweet about it and tweet it away, it's not going to go away anytime soon. So I think they're hoping that this special investigator, former FBI Director Mueller, would be able to come up with something or not come up with something, and they're hoping, I think, maybe this summer it'll start to dissipate. But it just doesn't seem like it's going to go anytime soon.
Well, they keep having self-inflicted wounds. Just at the time when you think, okay, we've worked that out. For example, the firing of the former FBI director, which Attorney General Sessions was very careful to say was not about the Russian investigation. And then the president gets on his Twitter account and says it is. That's in fact why I did it, and basically pulls the rug out from under his own people. I agree with Jaime. The special counsel, Robert Mueller, is a first-class guy. I think he's got the confidence of people on both sides of the aisle. When I was AG, he was the FBI director, and we got briefings from him, and I've never saw a hint of partisanship or a lack of very, very fundamental knowledge of what he was talking about. So I think they've got the right guy. If he has the room to run, we'll get answers, and that's what the country needs.
If I can get us out of the realm of politics briefly, because regardless of, I mean, if there was something going on between the Trump campaign and Russia, that's obviously goes to a much higher level. But if it is more of a tit-for-tat sort of thing, I mean, what came to mind for me is it seems to me there is a bipartisan possibility here of realizing how dangerous cyber hacking is, whether it's our election system or whatnot. And that seems to be, as I've heard from people in the community, they would like to hear more about how Congress, how the Senate is going to work together to try to fix that.
Oh, absolutely. And it is a major issue. And it's an issue that is not just at the federal level. It goes all the way down. I think our county elections recorders are very concerned about it. And they're looking about how they're going to improve their systems in order to make sure that doesn't happen in Arizona. But that is something that I think from a bipartisan and what we should be really focused on, and I think where the Trump administration could help themselves if they were to go after that issue with vigor. But it seems like they're trying to distance themselves from it, but without really acknowledging that that is a very critical issue that needs to be dealt with.
Well, and it seems like that's an issue that needs to be dealt with quickly. I mean, we've had elections since the presidential election. We have more coming up later this month, more elections coming up next year. And presumably, if things need to be done, they need to be done quickly. But the extent of the problem, it seems like, hasn't quite yet been identified. So how much more secure can we reasonably expect to be in 2018 than we were in 2016?
Well, this ought to be a national emergency focus because the confidence in our election system is absolutely critical to a democracy. And for a whole bunch of reasons, it isn't. It's become highly politicized. I'm just surprised that the Republican Party, which has been the most adamant in the past as being anti-red, anti-Russia, has suddenly thought, well, it's just fine. No problem. You meet with the ambassador secretly. You have business dealings there. That's not a problem. And boy, I've never seen such an expedient turnaround in terms of political posture for an entire group and Congress. I think it's a big deal. I think, in fact, if one of our most intense enemies on the international scale is trying to get into our elections and into our political process, I find that abhorrent, as do many others who've spoken out on it.
Well, and it's not just Russia, too. I think people are very concerned at what happens, what China is doing, what North Korea has done in certain instances. So I think the biggest piece is transparency as far as acknowledging that there are things that we need to do as a country and be very aggressive about it. And again, I think the Trump administration would help themselves if they were to
Amen.
Make this a higher priority.
Admit it's a problem and for a national focus, go after it with everything we've got. It shouldn't be marginalized.
And gentlemen, let's move on to the congressional shooting from earlier this week, which, Terry, as you said, reminded you of the Gabrielle Giffords shooting and many other people obviously shot in that 2011 situation. I mean, I hate to keep going on the theme of bipartisanship, having brought that up with the cybersecurity situation, but, you know, is there actual room for bipartisanship? And at what point do people take responsibility for whether political rhetoric is causing these things or not? Many of us hear the same political rhetoric, and now we see things on Twitter. How much seriousness do we place in these words, in these campaigns, as the money gets greater, is it getting nastier?
Well, I'm of the opinion that politics has always been nasty in our country. I think we have we long for the past where everybody says, oh, we were so nice to each other, but politics has always been a very rough business. But the thing that I laud our congressional leaders, especially after this event occurred, it seemed like, at least in Congress, I mean, you take away all the social media rhetoric and all the vitriol that was out there, who was to blame? Our congressional leaders really said, look, this is a time when we need to come together. And that show of unity, their willingness to have the game and pray together and come together, that was a very powerful message for our country. And I thought it was a very wonderful thing to see. And I hope that that leads to that kind of a feeling and attitude for other leaders that they could emulate.
But there's no question that to a greater degree than we've ever seen, and I mean, he's absolutely right. We've had political partisanship from the time of George Washington, when they said just awful things about each other. But they did go out and socialize that evening. There was a sense that we are political opponents, but we're not personal opponents. We don't hate the other guy. And the most important change of administration I think, in world history was the one from Adams to Jefferson, where two strong political opponents succeeded each other peacefully and no shots were fired. And wow, that was that changed the world right there. Right now, there's an increasing number of Americans who believe that the other side is evil, that they're bad people, and that they don't want to associate with them. And it seems to me that's what we've got to cut through. And absolutely, some of the things Paul Ryan and others said in response to the shooting, I mean, it's sad that it takes a shooting to bring out the best in our country, but maybe it does. But right here on this show yesterday, you had Representative Schweikert say, well, it's the Democrats that are making this much more hostile. And then shortly afterward, you had Senator Tim Kaine, who said, really, do you think that helps? This is something where you truly should stop throwing rocks and try to figure out what we have in common. And maybe the baseball game is a good place to start.
After the Gifford shooting in 2011, there was a lot of discussion about civility and bringing people together. There was a big deal made about Republicans and Democrats sitting together at the State of the Union. And when we spoke with Congressman Grijalva after the shooting this week, he said, yeah, we made an effort to be bipartisan and have civility, but it was kind of a half-hearted effort. Do either of you have any confidence that what you've seen in the wake of this week's shooting might last beyond the weekend, even that people, you know, Republicans and Democrats might try to work together and or even if not work together, maybe not be quite so mean to each other?
I do have hope. Maybe it's because I'm an optimist, but I look at people like Senator Flake, because if you recall, after the Giffords tragedy, he was one of the first ones to say, look, we need to come together. And I think his friendship with Gabby showed and then blossomed. But it needs to have that kind of leadership, people that are willing to stand up against even folks in their own party. Because remember, just recently, Senator Flake got attacked by his primary opponent in a very ugly, ugly fashion. Moments after the shooting, she does Kelly Ward does a fundraising piece and attacks Jeff. And it's that kind of what I call ugliness in politics that stirs the pot a little bit. But I think with if they have leaders that are willing to step out and say, you know, enough's enough. Look, we're gonna be partisan and we're gonna fight, but we don't have to be ugly about it.
And this is the NewsCap on KJZZ's The Show. Along with Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldsey. We'll continue the conversation in a moment with Terry Goddard and Jaime Malera. Stay with us. Happy Friday. It's The Show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of our Friday NewsCap segment with former Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard and former Superintendent of Public Instruction Jaime Malera, also of the firm Malera Alvarez. Terry, even though you were a little bit worried about the temperature, I want to give you a chance to get a final thought on it.
Yeah, I wish you'd stop reporting this 120 business. I would prefer to ignore that. But the point about partisanship is I think it may surprise some people today that Arizona has really been one of the great beneficiaries of bipartisan activity, leadership. I had the chance as a teenager to see Morris K. Udall and John Rhodes working together, a leader of the Republican Party and one of the primary Democrats, actually a presidential candidate in 72. So they were one of the most effective 1-2 punches in Congress, I think one of the most effective they've ever seen, and that benefited the state of Arizona greatly. So, you know, we cut ourselves off of great resources when we get too fixed on a single answer to a political question.
And Jaime, to close out the sort of this overall topic of bipartisanship or members of Congress working together, one of the things that strikes me, to be totally cynical, is to hear this idea of the members of Congress getting together, and many of them, as Terry said, if they've socialized in the past, maybe they're close friends, maybe they just are acquaintances. But is there anything to this concept of, whether it's Citizens United or other things, where it, in some ways, forgive me for being harsh, in some ways are these members of Congress sort of puppets, where they can do the work, they're the ones doing the everyday work, but then ultimately if someone says, hey, you know, we're going to send out a mailer to raise you $100,000, you're going to have to say some harsh things. Is that too cynical? It seems that way sometimes.
No, it's not too cynical. It's very cynical.
accurate.
I think a lot of it is on the individual member. I mean, I think you've seen examples of members that are willing to be incredibly partisan and have a lot of belief in their convictions of why they're doing what they're doing, but they don't have to be mean about it. I mean, they don't have to have that mean spirit that tends to drive a wedge in our society. And I think that's the difference. Terry mentioned Rhodes and
Udall.
But I think just in recent history, you had Pastore and John Kyle that worked together on a number of issues. And they were incredibly far apart of the political spectrum, but yet they were able to sit down and work on some very major issues for the state of Arizona. So I think it comes down to the individual.
And let's be frank. I can't resist the opportunity to talk about dark money and the corrosive impact it's had upon politics in America. The fact is that most of these candidates for Congress and Senate especially don't control most of the ads that are done either in favor of them or against their opponent. It's done by this shadow group that nobody can identify because we have huge amounts of corporate money after the Citizens United case that has poured into American politics. Now, since that's irresponsible money, nobody is accountable for it. No candidate has to say, yeah, that's my ad. I approve the content. It's done by a third party, and the overwhelming majority of those ads are negative, viciously negative. There's nobody to sue, for example, if you are libeled by an ad like that, because it's you have to unwrap a huge and complicated chain of political money laundering. And I think that's a big part of why we see a much more hostile and vituperative session in Congress. These people aren't responsible for much of the ads that are done in the political framework.
Moving to a subject that generally does have bipartisan support, dealing with the opioid epidemic, both here in Arizona and across the country, Governor Ducey is requiring that agencies do faster reporting now from deaths caused by overdose of these medications. I mean, on a practical level, like, what kind of impact do you think this might have?
Well, I think it will have an impact, at least the media attention that's being generated. Last year, we had nearly 800 people die from opioid overdose. Almost more than two people a day were dying in Arizona alone. So that's something to be alarmed about. And I think our healthcare community, from our hospitals to our health plans, and everybody in between our docs, need to understand what needs to be done here. And there needs to be better communication. There needs to be more transparency. So I think that was helpful. I know that Ducey's access director, Tom Betlack, has made this a priority within the entire Medicaid framework. And I think that's going to be very helpful in addressing this issue.
Terry, we heard this week that the current attorney general is looking at valley-based manufacturer of these medications. What kind of role might that play in dealing with this epidemic and maybe trying to get a handle on it?
I think it's a group effort, and you're right to say initially that it's bipartisan. I think this is killing young people in our communities, and I think there's a perception, unfortunately, some irresponsible drug companies have made it sound like OxyContin and some of the other opioids are like candy. They're perfectly safe, no problem. Not true. And so education is important. Tracking, as Governor Ducey has tried to put in place, find out who are the repeat users, who are going to multiple emergency room visits. We need to know that, and we need to take action because it's a deadly, deadly part of our environment right now. And I think people, unfortunately, have underestimated because it's a prescription drug. It looks healthy. It looks like all the other pills you get. It's not. It's a really dangerous and the over-prescription, unfortunately, of painkillers has become almost a societal epidemic, and we need to stand up against it.
And Terry, briefly, an issue close to your heart, national monuments and the Trump administration's review of them bears ears. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke has recommended that be cut back. Give us a Cliff's Notes version.
Well, thank you. Let me try to do it briefly. Basically, the president put out an order that 27 national monuments that have been presented by his predecessors through both parties should be reviewed. The first one that they teed up on a much shorter turnaround basis was Bears Ears. I have a personal and very intense feeling about the Bears Ears National Monument, which was over a million acres of a perfectly spectacular part of southern Utah that was designated by President Obama right at the end of his administration and designated in a really unique way. Bears Ears is the first federal property of this kind which would be jointly administered by the U.S. Department of Interior and five Native American tribes. Amazing, and I think appropriate for this property, which is perhaps the most intense area of cultural importance in the country. I've been up there, gone through some of the areas where the cliff paintings, the number of potsherds, the number of sacred sites to many different tribes is unprecedented. And I think it needs to be protected. I hate the idea that this would be cut back, and I think it's wrongheaded because we've got a great resource here.
So as we wrap up, Mark, I think it's time for, as we hear, it's going to be 120 next week.
Please don't say that.
I think it's important. Terry's going to run out of the room.
I think it's important to ask our guests. Jaime, your worst, in 30 seconds, your worst hot summer story of living in Phoenix.
Oh, that's easy. When it was 122, the record in Phoenix, I was a student at Arizona State University. I was going to summer school and working, and the day before, my bike got stolen. So I had to walk miles and miles and miles that day, and I'll never forget that. That was the worst hot day story.
I can't top that. I was running for governor on the 22nd of June, 2010, and it was just another hot day in Arizona. But Jaime's got the record here.
And Mark, you're not a native. What about you?
Man, I think anytime you have to get into your car when it's been sitting outside for any length of time when it's that hot, it's got to be probably the worst.
Where the oven mitts when you grab the steering wheel.
Yeah, and okay. I think with Jaime, I think the person who stole your bike might have actually saved you because sitting on the seat after it's been sitting out, baking out in the sun for any amount of time, might have caused some real problems there.
True. So the advice is take lots of water, stay in the shade. Adopt a wonderful Latin American custom of sleeping in the afternoon.
Yes,
and lock your bikes.
Right, you lock your bikes.
I'm Malera of Malera Alvarez, former Attorney General Terry Gutter. Thanks for joining us on the Newscap, guys.
Thank you very much, Steve.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.